You are about to experience Jackson Snyder Presents. Direct from the Veroesin Yahad, a Hebrew Nation radio original program. JSP is a variety show seeking out Jewish and Christian origins, religion, theology, and history, and doing so in a fashion that is both educational and entertaining. Welcome to Jackson Snyder Presents.
Good evening. Welcome to Jackson Snyder Presents. Thanks for coming. Tonight we're going to start a series, probably two episodes, maybe three. AFK? AFK. I don't know what that means.
Away from keyboard.
Oh, I see. Well, as I was saying, a minor Bible personality that led a most complicated secular life. Now, that Bible personality is a man called Epaphroditus. He's found in Philippians, as we will see, and Colossians as a companion of Paul, and undoubtedly on Paul's journeys with him right up until the end. And we're going to start with those passages from the New Testament that talk a little about him, starting with the Acts. I think in conclusion, you'll find that Epaphroditus was quite influential, well beyond our greatest guess concerning somebody. That is, he did more, he was more notorious, more infamous, and one who finally died for his faith in about 96 AD. Let me take you to the screen share. And we start out in Acts chapter 16, right at the beginning. Paul came to Derbe, and then to Lystra, where a disciple named Timothy lived, whose mother was Jewish and a believer, but whose father was a Greek. You who know, what did that make Timothy? Jewish or pagan? Hebrew or Greek? I've heard that Judaism extends through the mother rather than the father, but we see in the Bible that Hebrewism extends through the father most of the time in the genealogy. I don't know. The believers at Lystra and Iconium spoke well of him. Paul wanted to take him along on the journey, so he circumcised him because of the Jews who lived in that area, for they all knew that his father was a Greek. I take a little geographical tour there, down here where we're at. We're on the subcontinent of Anatolia, today's Turkey. Turkey after the Muslims came, but this is before, so we don't find anyone but pagans here, and now enclaves of Pauline Christianity. On this hump, we find Lystra, Iconium, and Derbe. And I'm supposing that this dotted line here is his journeying. You can see he came through Tarsus, through a mountain pass, and onto these little towns. Verse 6, Paul and his companions. Now, we don't have just Paul. We've got companions. Traveled through the region of Phrygia and Galatia, having been kept by the Holy Spirit from preaching the word in the province of Asia. Again, we're in the same area. Phrygia's right in the middle of Anatolia. Galatia, Cappadocia, down here's Tarsus, on the west side of Anatolia, southwest. Here's a couple more that are mentioned, Pisidia, Pamphylia, and they call this whole place Asia at that time. Well, it says extreme western Asia, at any rate, so we're moving. And in verse 11 of Acts 16, we have the famous beginning, I should say the beginning of the famous We document. It's called that because in verse 11, it says, from Troas, we put out to sea and sailed straight for Samothrace, or Samothrake is the correct pronunciation. What makes this special is that all of a sudden, somebody is writing this from the perspective of being there, we, and why this chapter and all through the rest of Acts is set out from the rest. And some would say that there was a different source. A source that was biographical, but not only so, but also autobiographical, that whoever Luke was used this particular source to end up his book of Acts. So the we document, or the we passages. And we can see here, after Samothrake, The next day, we went on to Neapolis. So Samothrake is an island place here. Neapolis is a port. You can see where we're going with that. We're moving. We're moving west across the sea. What sea is that? Aegean Sea? Yes, it is. The Aegean Sea. Toward Greece. Then on to Macedonia. From there, in verse 12, we travel to Philippi, a Roman colony and the leading city of that district of Macedonia. And we stayed there several days. Of course, Macedonia is the origination of Alexander the Great and his father, Philip, whom he never knew. And that's where we get the names of Philippi and the origination of Alexander. Now we're across the Aegean. We're on the east side of the country called Macedonia. In fact, it's been called Greece for a long time. But just recently, I'd say in the last 10 or 15 years, Macedonia has become, once again, free of Greece. So from that port city that we talked about in the last slide, we go to Philippi, Amphipolis, Apollonia, to Thessalonica, and Pella, not the one in Israel, and on to Edessa. So here's where we start encountering Epaphroditus. Preceding the trip to Philippi, Paul had sent the following letter. We're going to Philippians now, chapter 2, and starting at verse 19, where Paul writes, "I hope in the Master Yeshua to send Timothy to you soon, that I may also be cheered when I receive news about you, for I have no one else like him who will show genuine concern for your welfare." My internet's unstable, it says, so I'm going to wait for that to end. Okay, we're back. And then we skip to 23. "I hope, therefore, to send him as soon as I see how things go with me, and I'm confident in the Master that I myself will come soon." And in the map before, we see that he was almost there by this time. This is a letter of Paul's intention. So we've got Timothy again, and finally he admits that he himself will be coming, and soon. And he continues in verse 25, "But I think it's necessary to send back to you Epaphroditus," and that's the subject of our essay today, "who Paul calls my brother, co-worker, fellow soldier, who is also your messenger, whom you sent to take care of my needs." Paul and Timothy plan to travel back to Philippi, get that right, "for he longs for all of you, you Philippian people, and is distressed because you heard he was ill. Indeed, he was ill and almost died. But Eloah had mercy on him, and not on him only, but also on me, to spare me sorrow upon sorrow." So Epaphroditus and Paul are pretty close. They're travel companions, after all. He's got to send Epaphroditus to recover from his sickness. And so he says in 28, "Therefore, I'm all the more eager to send him, so that when you see him again," he's been there before, "you may be glad, and I may have less anxiety. So then, welcome him in the Master with great joy, and honor people like him, because he almost died for the work of Messiah. He risked his life to make up for the help you yourselves could not give me." That's a little bit of a backslap right there. So it looks to me like Epaphroditus got really sick somewhere, had to lay out for a while, and being sent to recover back to Philippi to take up the journey again. We find that Epaphroditus, who's also called Epaphras, they're the same name, the same first 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 letters. So I think we are pretty good in saying that this is the same person. And going over to Colossians, the gospel is bearing fruit and growing throughout the whole world, just as it has been doing among you since the day you heard it and truly understood Eloah's grace, underline, or favor, means the same thing. "You learned it from Epaphras, our dear fellow servant, who's a faithful minister of Messiah on our behalf, and who also told us of your love in the Spirit." So you see, Paul wasn't the only evangelist going about, and I could almost see a number of part-time evangelists. After all, they had to keep making a living somehow. They had to keep sowing into that ministry. Like in Europe during 2 centuries ago, all the farmers would come home from their having to bear the burden of being mercenaries for whoever their king or prince was. They had to come home in the summer months in order to keep the farm going. And then when it got cold after the harvest time, they would be forced to go back into the local army and be sent somewhere. In Germany, some of the local armies were sent here to the United States during the Revolution. That's where a lot of the Germans in this country came from. They came to fight for the British, and here they stayed. They liked it so much, or maybe they just couldn't afford to get home. So Epaphras, or Epaphroditus, was the messenger, the angel to Colossae. And here we are. I'm thinking we're back out of the Aegean again, and we're over here in Anatolia. You can see this is some of John's area in the time after Paul. John became the bishop of this entire area. Here's Colossae, Ephesus, Thralia, Magnesia, Priene, Miletus, the seven churches, Smyrna, Sardis, etc. Paul's gone, John's in, at least the way we understand it. And once again, take a look at where we are. And remember that Bishop Ignatius also wrote letters to many of these same assemblies here, including the letter to the Magnesians, in which he tells the people there not to keep the Sabbath anymore and to stay away from the Jews entirely. Such a breakdown. And that was only less than a generation after Paul. Here's another connection from Colossians 4:12. Epaphras, who is one of you and a servant of Messiah Yeshua, he sends greetings. He's always wrestling in prayer for you, that you may stand firm in all the will of Elohim, mature and fully assured. It reminds me of Sean, always on his face for me. It is a wonderful joy to know that someone is praying for you. How many of you were delivered over to Christianity by, say, an ancient aunt, maybe even before you were born, praying for you, praying you out of the world and into the kingdom? I venture to say that some of you are, or have been. I vouch for him, says Paul, that he is working hard for you and for those at Laodicea and Hierapolis. Our dear friend Luke, I've underlined his name, the doctor, and Demas send greeting. So what we have here in this pericope is pairing up. We've got Epaphras and we've got Luke in the same paragraph or pericope. Finally, this man is also mentioned in the letter to Philemon, and Philemon is in Colossae in the province of Phrygia, Roman province. And we look at Philemon, this simply has one chapter. We look at verse 23. Epaphras, my fellow prisoner in Messiah Yeshua, sends you greetings. And so does Mark, Aristarchus, Demas, and Luke, my fellow workers. So we have this name Epaphras, who we are pretty sure is the same as Epaphroditus, just a shortened name. And Luke hooked up again. Why is that important? Because one of the things we're trying to discover is who wrote the book of Acts, and even more so, who wrote the we document? Who was on the trip? Who wrote his own autobiography on that trip as to where Paul and his friends went? And we know that putting the gospel and the Acts in the authorship of Luke was just a fiat of the church of the second century. They don't really know who wrote those books or any of the four gospels. Nobody is identified in there, much less do you know who Theophilus is, whom Luke or whoever wrote the third gospel sent the letters to. And we might be able to even squeeze this out of the mystery of Epaphroditus. So on the map, same old place. Here's Phrygia, Galatia, though they're not sure where Galatia is yet. Others think that it's in France. Could be. Paul went to Britain. If he did go to Britain, then he came back by the continent rather than by the sea, and he would have certainly gone through Gaul, because you had to go through Gaul to get back down to Rome on the continent. That would be another good study for us to do, Paul in Britain. There's a lot there that we could use. And here's a couple of the other cities, Pisidia, Pamphylia, and we've got a red road going up to a purple road. You remember Pontus in Asia, Bithynia, Mysia. Somebody's going along. Here's a stone that was found with the name on it. Now, we can read in places like Wikipedia that this is a common name of slaves, but I can only find three people that were named Epaphroditus. Evidently, this one is pretty famous to have such a titular as this. They found this is in perfect condition. They put it out into the into the weather so everybody could see it. Now, there's a crack here on these peas, and the thing is starting to fall apart for the weather. Beautiful example of Roman engraving, that particular style. Wish we could get that in a font. So as I mentioned, there are three that we know of, two of which could be the same person because they have a very close biography. In fact, all three could be the same person. There's Epaphroditus of the Council, a Roman citizen, and will primarily follow his life. It's Epaphroditus of Chaeronea, whose life is a mirror image of the first. I believe they're the same person. Very close biography. Same birth and death. And finally, the Epaphroditus of the New Testament. Why couldn't they all be three be the same thing? It's only us in our wisdom that separates them. There's so much. This Epaphroditus from the Bible evidently died at the same time these two did, 96 AD. In fact, all three were born about 25 and died about 96. What is that, 71 years? It's a lifespan. All three were men of letters and sponsors of the careers of others. I'm just going to say that they are all three the same, because really, I think in reality, they are. All three traveled to similar places. They're like a trinity, three but one. The three are the same person. And if this is the case, yes, a case could be made for that. Many have tried. Then our biblical Epaphroditus is a very famous person of the court of at least five emperors, a convert, and possibly even the author of the We document. This is interesting. We haven't looked at him too much before because Epaphroditus is in the foreword or the preface to all of Josephus' works. They're dedicated to Epaphroditus, this very same one. There's another linkage, which I would hope to get to next time. Epaphroditus and Josephus, very good friends. Remember, Josephus fled Israel for Alexandria, Egypt. Then he went up to Rome to claim his inheritance with the Flavians. He was adopted a son of Vespasian, the Flavian emperor, who began his work as the emperor about 70 AD, even during the siege of Jerusalem that his son Titus was commencing. Epaphroditus stayed for five emperors. Then something happened. Full name? We can learn something from this. This took a lot of research. Let me tell you, there's not much on there about this. Titus, Claudius, Epaphroditus, Augusti, Libertus. Now, if we break it down a little bit, we can assume that he was a slave to the emperor Claudius. Claudius is in his name. Slaves and ex-slaves took the name of their masters often. Claudius reigned 41 through 54. This is prime area for the spread of the gospel, 54. And that area within a couple of years is given to Paul's letters to the Corinthians, Romans. And this Epaphroditus, as a freeman, Augusti Libertus, set free by Claudius, was surely some kind of literary agent because he supported Josephus with money, and he supported a Greek philosopher too, Epictetus, with money. So this Epaphroditus, evidently getting close to the top and being freed by Claudius, got some money from that means. And all emperors after Octavius, let's see, Octavius died in 14 AD and was the longest lived emperor at 40 some years. Octavius, who was called Augustus, were known as Augusti, which means respected and impressive. We still use the word the August so-and-so. Libertus means at liberty or free. So there we go. Claudius set him free, must have done something great. Maybe he bought himself free. During the entirety of Claudius' reign, Paul was traveling. The dates match up perfectly for the freedmen to travel with him. That is to say, have you not heard of somebody deeply involved in business or government that takes some time off to go work in a mission someplace? Being from a missionary family, I have met many of those kind of people. They take 2 weeks, they take a summer off, or they take certain years off to go on the mission field or to travel. And quite often to take up a place in a mission field where they can just paint or sit around or go sailing or lay on the beach, some of them. Paul says that Epaphroditus was left someplace, I'm not sure where, for Asthenia. In our Bible say sick, but actually, literally, that word says that he became weak, or better, not strong, because the word sthenia, here's the Greek, means strong. And the A at the beginning of it means not. So it would be not strong, or the opposite, weak. He was weak. Don't a lot of people get weak when they take sea voyages? Absolutely they do. Sometimes they just plain get sick. So Claudius, he rules until his wife Agrippina fed him that poison mushroom, his favorite dish. I mean, not poison, but unpoisoned mushroom. Agrippina was, of course, Caligula's sister and Claudius's niece. So here we have niece marriage, spoken of so much in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And of course, those scrolls, some of them, were undoubtedly written during this time. Not only emperors, but Romans in particular were known to make concubines of their nieces, Herods, all of them. There were a lot of Herods ruling here and there, a lot here in the east, that is to say Syria, what we call Syria today, Lebanon, Israel. They all had a niece to wife or as a concubine. Think of Herod Antipas. You remember Herod Antipas got hooked up with Salome. He sent his wife over to his brother Philip and said, here, you can have her. I'm taking this girl. And Salome's mother, what was her name? I know her father's name. Oh, Herodia. Herodia. Her father's name was Aristobulus. And if you look at Acts, at Romans chapter 15, you'll find that Aristobulus in there, along with the littlest Herod, Herodion, as friends of Paul and kinsmen. One of the main things that point to Paul as a Herodian. So he was in the capacity as secretary with Nero as well. Nero, again, was the nephew of Claudius, the husband of his mother. And of course, his mother was also married to Claudius and to, what was that guy's name? The red beard, they called Nero's father. Paul's biblical travels came to an end in 58, at least in one particular account, and that's in Rome. He spent 2 years in prison there. And doesn't it say in the Acts along the end that he stayed in a rented house? If he stayed there 2 years, then that brings us to 60 AD. And that was the time that he supposedly left Rome and went to Britain by way of Spain. And yes, I do believe that he went to Britain. Too much left behind in Britain. Paul is friends with Brits, including Druids. There were a lot of senators in Britain that were there during the war. Claudius started a war with Britain to take over. They did some good. They lost probably 250,000 250,000 Roman soldiers there, and about the same in Britain, same as British. Vespasian was there. Aulus Plautius was there, Roman general. A lot of the personnel we see were in Britain. Let's see who else. Constantine's father, who was emperor before him, was from Britain. That makes me wonder about Constantine's faith, because the scourge of the religious world in Britain at that time and at this time was the Chaldees, Chaldee meaning strangers, that came to Britain with Joseph of Arimathea to include Simon the Zealot, also known as Simon bar Cleopas. And in legend, Mary, the mother of Yahshua, was there as well. And there's still the ruins of a church given over to the name of Mary in Glastonbury. Lots of really cool tradition that Joseph of Arimathea, whom I call Yosef Hari Matya, believing that Arimathea is a made-up name or a problem with the translation into Greek. He was supposedly a tin merchant and traveled all over.
You may contact us at Jackson Snyder Presents at this email address, veroyahad@gmail.com. That is veroyahad @gmail.com. And let me remind you, you are listening to Jackson Snyder Presents with your host tonight, Bogdan G. Shrumkov. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. Jackson Snyder Present is back. Join us now for more of this interesting discussion.
There are legends telling us that the reason that Yahshua was not biographized in his growing up years, the lost years, is because he was with his uncle, or possibly his father. Remember, his father's name was Joseph as well. There's a name game in the New Testament. If you want to know who someone is, you've got to track down the names. There's a Joseph, the carpenter, that all of a sudden disappears. And when he disappears, another Joseph just pops up. Joseph Arimathea. Arimathea. At this time, by 60 AD, Paul going forth again, but as far as we know, when Paul is there entertaining his friends for 2 years in a rented house, Epaphroditus is also there. This is the rule and reign of Nero. Epaphroditus' home was in Rome. On July 18, 64 AD, a fire started in the enormous Circus Maximus Stadium in Rome, which is now, of course, the capital of Italy. When the fire was finally extinguished 6 days later, I know you're probably already reading this, 10 of Rome's 14 districts had burned up. Total destruction. Think of all the people displaced. Nero was kind enough to allow a lot of these refugees to come up and set up Sukkot in his gardens while he was providing light for the night with the bodies of Christians, setting them up on poles and putting some type of burning liquid on them, maybe even Greek fire, burning those bodies right before all the ones that had been dislocated by the fire. Understand that I think with one match, you could burn down all of Rome. This was also prophesied. Go back and look again to Revelation 18. We have the whore of Babylon in the city of the whore. Actually, the whore is both Rome and Jerusalem. Both of them burned up. But Rome in 64 AD, ancient historians blamed Rome's infamous emperor Nero for the fire. This is where Nero fiddled while Rome burned, but he didn't really fiddle. He played the lyre from the top of the palace, watching the beautiful conflagration and thinking about his new city, Neropolis, that he was going to put over all that was burned, with this great golden dome that he imagined, and he's happy. In fact, he's singing a song of his own composition called The Destruction of Troy. I don't think that we still have that song these days, but there are a few songs that Nero might have written. That's what he was most famous for as a performer, especially in Greece. Nero would take lots of time off from being the emperor to go over to Greece and travel there and enter the contests of singers and actors. That's what he liked to do best. In fact, when the one in Josephus called Sallust is sent by King Agrippa as a messenger to Nero, he's in Greece at that time, competing in contests. Is Sallust and Paul the same? I'm not sure, but it seems like it. The act of the fire starter, who was probably Ophonius Tigellinus, he was the prefect of the Praetorian Guard. He undoubtedly got to hear every day Nero talk about Neropolis. And so I'm going to venture to guess that Tigellinus was instructed by Nero to burn down Rome because it stunk so bad, especially in the summertime. So it can be replaced with something much better that the people like better, but that Nero would have a city named after him for all eternity. Neropolis. Neropolis is Greek, meaning city. We're going to 68 now. When the people caught on to Nero's scheme, look, this is 2 years later, Nero blamed the Christians for burning Rome, and he got away with it for 2 years. Understand that Christians now and Christians then were quite different. They called them in Rome Christians, with an E instead of an I. Of course, you know that Christ is a Greek word. It means Messiah. It bothers me even to say it or to place Christ beside the name Yahshua. Why did they not translate that? They translated everything else in English, but they didn't rightly transliterate his name or his rank as Messiah. So the masses stormed the palace. And this is, like I mentioned, 2 years later, after the fire was done, after a lot of people had to leave Rome or find someplace to stay. How many? 10 of Rome's 14 districts destroyed? What you see in Rome now was not destroyed, with the exception of the Colosseum, which, as you know, came a few years later during the time that Vespasian was the emperor. The scene as shown in Quo Vadis, the movie, maybe from 1951, of the people storming the palace is absolutely chilling. Most of that movie is, for realism. If you haven't seen it yet, please see it, remember it, because if you want to hear me, I can see there are probably hundreds here today. I talk a lot about these things because they're so important in the history of our faith. Nero went to sleep. When he woke up, he found that his Praetorian Guard, his personal guard, had deserted him, including the head of that, who carried out most of his dirty work, Tigellinus. They couldn't control such a crowd anyway. But one person remained by Nero's side, a person that I can hardly believe would be in the same types of despotic activities as Nero, that being the freedman of Claudius, Epaphroditus. If he had been, do you think Paul would have had him come along? In the missionary business, you put up with a lot of things in order to be underwritten. You have to put up with whatever your underwriter does. Oftentimes, your underwriter will tell you what to do because they're supporting your ministry financially. Remember Chloe's people? Okay, Chloe was an underwriter of Paul's work. So in one of his letters, he talks about Chloe's people. He's got to let her know that, yes, this is wrong. I'm going to weigh in on this. Undoubtedly, he got a letter from Chloe and her people. Undoubtedly, some were slaves. Undoubtedly, she had some kind of enterprise going, or she had a lot of people working for her. I thought women couldn't do that kind of thing. Oh, but they could. They could. If there was no male left to run the business. If a maiden's father died and she was unmarried, yes, she could, with a certain amount of maturity. Epaphroditus stayed with Nero, who got Nero up and away from the palace before the mob got him. Yeah, I know. I'm repeating myself for the 50th time. And that's how we get now to 68 AD, the year Peter and Paul were supposedly executed as part of the extermination of Christians in the Roman Empire, and especially in Rome, for burning it down. That is the main reason why the Neronic persecution, in the Bible it's called the Great Tribulation, came to pass. And it came to pass just exactly as Paul and John and several others predicted it would, very quickly, immediately. I want to end up here with a short essay. It's a good little essay in the public domain describing the death of Nero and Epaphroditus' part in it. And then we'll end up for tonight. And next time, I want to go into who Epaphroditus is in the realm of the kingdom, because I've gone through the story here pretty much, but I haven't picked the goodies off of it for you yet. We'll do that next time. The essay is by Natasha Sheldon. Before he left Rome, Nero tried to bribe the officers of the Praetorian Guard to help him. Their reply was not encouraging. Is it so terrible a thing to die? One reputedly asked the emperor. Following this rejection, the desperate Nero considered his option. One was to flee to Parthia. That was the enemy, the empire of the enemy. While another was to wait and throw himself on the mercy of the advancing Galba. Galba was a general from Spain, an old man, bringing troops to Rome from Spain to take over the government. Nero was proclaimed a public enemy, and so they had to have somebody else come in. Here comes Galba. I think he's 70 years old at this time, marching across Spain to Rome. Nero toyed with the idea of publicly petitioning the Roman people for the prefecture of Egypt. Oh, just let me step down. Let me step down and be the president of Egypt. That's not too much to ask, is it? But he gave up the idea when he realized he was likely to be torn apart. The night of June the 8th must have passed uneasily for Nero. However, the next day was far worse. The ex-emperor awoke to discover his bodyguard had left him. So, gathering his remaining four servants, And then it says, one of which was a gladiator named Sporus. They made a mistake in here. Nero did marry a gladiator, a male, a great big guy, 7 foot tall, but he wasn't Sporus. Sporus was a boy, a small boy, that he married because he had kicked his wife Poppaea to death. She was very beautiful, and he found this boy that looked just like her, Sporus. Funny thing, his name means seed. Nero had him castrated, actually had a wedding in the palace to be married to Sporus and to the gladiator as well, and I can't remember his name right now, and Epaphroditus, then we're looking into. And he fled Rome barefoot and in disguise for the villa of his freedman, Phaon. All right, here's another freedman who's got his own place somewhere outside the palace, 4 miles outside. Nero then passed the next few hours of vacillating over his death. When his servants begged him to avoid ignominious execution by committing suicide, it's the only manly thing to do. It's the only way you're going to keep your reputation. Appeared, decided, and ordered them to dig him a grave. However, while they did so, he wandering around, bewailing his fate and muttering, "Dead and so great an artist." Then a letter arrived, and Nero learned the Senate had declared him a public enemy. The letter also stated that the Senate had decreed the ex-emperor should be captured and brought to Rome for execution, ancient style. This meant that Nero was to be stripped naked, with his head secured in a wooden fork, and publicly flogged to death, then thrown down the steps into the grotto, into the gulf outside of Rome. The news sent Nero into a frenzy panic. He snatched up 2 daggers and tried the points as if to kill himself, only to throw down again, protesting the time of his death had not yet come. Nero then changed his mind and asked Sporus to mourn him. He then begged for one of his remaining servants to set him an example by killing themselves first. The next moment, the increasingly erratic emperor was berating himself for his cowardice. You remember Revelation chapter 13, the beast with the head wound? Well, this is where he was pointing the daggers to his brain, up through his neck. Suetonius, who wrote the Lives of the Caesars, records how witnesses stated he bewailed how ugly and vulgar my life has become before turning on himself, saying, "Come, pull yourself together." Hooves from a troop of cavalry approached the villa to arrest Nero, finally decided the matter. Rather than face execution, the cornered Nero chose to end his own life. He made his companions promise to bury him respectably. Then he took up the dagger. However, Nero couldn't quite summon the courage to plunge the knife home himself. He'd done this to so many other people, ought to be easy. His secretary, Epaphroditus, had to help him stab himself in the throat. The arresting centurion arrived just in time to catch the emperor's last breath, but despite his outlaw status, respected Nero's last wishes. Galba's freedman, Icalus, cremated the emperor in the gold-embroidered robes he had just last worn in Greece. Now, if that was Paul and Josephus' solace, these are the robes that Paul would have seen Nero in during his performances. His ashes, however, were placed among those of his father's family, the Domitii. You know, Nero's real first name was Domitius, same as the emperor to come 3 after him. On the Pincian Hill, rather than amongst the other Julio-Claudians, he didn't get in the family tomb of the famous family, but he got into his father's tomb, Ahenobarbus, that was his name, which means something like red beard. After Nero's death, the citizens of Rome reputably celebrated in the street. However, some mourned. The Greeks were one group that mourned. They loved him. However, there were also some in Rome who still revered Nero. According to, again, Suetonius, you can get his little book on Amazon for about $1 or $2. It's funny. It has the dirt on all these emperors in the Claudian line. It became customary for people to lay spring and summer flowers on Nero's grave in the years after his death, and some even erected the emperor's statue on the rostra in the forum. Others continued to circulate Nero's edicts as if he was still alive, while rumors began to circulate that the emperor was not dead, but returned to confound his enemies. And what does Revelation 13 again say about the beast, about him not being dead or returning to life? He was wounded in the head, but his head healed, his wound healed. And 666 was the number of his name, which just so happens to be Kaiseros Neron, 666. No, it's not Ronald Reagan. The fact no one had seen Nero's corpse fanned the flames of these rumors, as did his private burial. The rumors were also not helped by the fact that Nero's natal chart, I guess that's an astrology chart, reputedly foretold he would lose his empire only to recover it in the East. Hey, that's Revelation 13. However, oh, by the way, that's a Sibylline oracles. If you've got the Jewish pseudepigrapha on your shelf, you'll find it in there. It's Jewish, a Jewish prophecy that he would come back, that he was of the tribe of Dan, D-A-N, the tribe that supposedly was the tribe of the Antichrist. And isn't that tribe left out of Revelation chapter 7 in the 144,000? I think so. However, whatever their initial basis, the rumor of Nero's survival didn't go away. And over the next 20 years, not one, but three individuals claiming to be Nero came forward and tried to take the empire. Let me get this straight. Nero goes to Phaon's little house and there struggles with suicide. And then a cavalryman come past there looking for him. And they did what Nero asked them to do in the end. What if they pretended that Nero was dead? What if they came up with a bushel of ashes, said we burned him? What if the cavalry was in on the deal? After all, they were his cavalry. He was the emperor. What if Epaphroditus, Phaon, and some of the other one rushed him to the coast, put him on a pirate ship, sent him to Parthia, or sent him to Macedonia, where he would be welcome? That is a mystery. It's mysterious. I'm taken with this false Nero stuff. Of course, the scripture says that the head wound was healed. If that scripture is talking about Nero, the beast, and I'm sure it is, even the Sibylline oracles say that. I'm sure it is, unless you want to try to put Revelation out in the future again, when John says, we'll see, I'm going off the topic here, when John says that I come quickly. Over the next 20 years, not one, but three claim to be Nero, okay? The first false Nero emerged just months after Nero's death in the place where the emperor was most loved, Greece. The false Nero gathered a group of army deserters and set sail for Italy. However, Emperor Galba, who took the imposter seriously, sent forces out to intercept and kill Nero. Evidently, Galba, who was a pretty smart guy, he only lasted as emperor for 6 months. His new Praetorian Guard killed him right off the bat. Why? Because Galba wouldn't pay them anymore. He was a general. You are paid enough. Do your job. Okay. Took the imposter seriously, sent forces there to return his decapitated head to Rome for public display. That happened, and then 10 years passed. Now we're in the end of Vespasian's rule. I think he passed away in 79, the year of Vesuvius. After Vespasian's death, not one but two false Neros arose, and one during the reign of Vespasian's eldest son, Titus, and the other under his unstable and unpopular son, Domitian. Wow. Both of these false Neros were sponsored by the Parthians, who, after causing a good deal of unrest among the Roman ruling elite, handed their Neros over for retribution. The Parthians' motives were clear: humiliate and possibly destabilize their old enemy, Rome, as much as possible. That's why Israel went back and forth from Rome to Parthia. Remember, King Jonathan, who was also the high priest, called on the great Pompey, Roman general, to come into Israel and help him put down some of these people that were rebelling. And Pompey came in with his legions and took over everything. You better know who you're asking before you ask a favor. Then the Parthians struck not long after, and they took over. And then the Romans came in again and took over. And would you believe this was the story for, let's see, 250 years, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. However, they could not have hoped to succeed in their plans unless they believed the return of Nero would have some support among the peoples of the Roman Empire, particularly in Rome. And Epaphroditus was alive at this time. Is it a coincidence that both Epaphroditus and Josephus disappeared in the same year, 96? Well, is it possible that when Domitian decided to execute Clement, the Nazarene Acts Clement, the friend of Paul Clement from Philippians, that also his adopted brother, cousin, Josephus disappeared and Epaphroditus disappeared all at the same time? That's what I want to look into. Professor Edward Champlin, author of Nero, The End of a Dynasty, believes Nero was not as universally loathed as people think. He believes it was the, quote, senators and leading knights described by Tacitus that truly hated Nero. And you know what? He's probably right. Nero gave a lot of stuff to people. He did some of the same things that Duvaliers did in Haiti when they were ruling. Every once in a while, they'd drive their train of limousines down through road number one there in Port-au-Prince, throwing out nickels and dimes, hundreds and thousands of nickels and dimes. And when finally they quit the country because of their fear of the United States, they took the entire treasury with them. And that nation state, the oldest black republic on this side of the earth, has been a failure ever since that happened. The plebeian poor made up 90% of the population of Rome. I added something there too, that 75% were slaves. They liked him. He freed his slaves. There were the people who had benefited from Nero's reign, who, quote, ate his banquets and joined in enthusiastically with his performances. They weren't offended by Nero's excesses or murderous tendencies, as long as their own lives saw some benefit. We kind of feel that way too. Somebody today who was over here talking about, if the government shuts down, are they going to pay my Social Security? Well, we'll find out. They may have turned on Nero at his end, but when times became tough for them, they looked upon his rule as a golden age, and so were all too willing to cling to the idea that, like King Arthur, Nero might successfully return. I think that he got away. Why is he going with his freedmen? To kill himself? Maybe ostensibly, but Nero wasn't the type to kill himself. He liked to kill other people. Let's see what you look like. You, the gallery. Everybody's gone by now. Well, that's all I want to share with you tonight. The next night, I think I'm going to keep this fresh and maybe do it Thursday. So if you can't make it Thursday, you can get the recording of it Thursday. I'm not promising, because I never know when my affliction's going to raise its weathered head. So we're going to look at Epaphroditus in his own life, in his own literary life, and how there are too many coincidences that this is the man that Paul loved so much and wrote so little about. And then finally, thank you. Thank you, Gregory. Finally, next time, we're going to look at who Theophilus is. I think I got it. Of course, these mysteries, they need solutions. There's a lot of New Testament mysteries, and I wish I could find somebody that was interested in them, because I have a lot of them I'd like to discuss with somebody. Maybe you. Let me see. Before I go, thank you, Bryant, Sean, Vicky, and Gregory. Yahweh bless you and keep you tonight. Hope to see you Thursday.
You have been listening to Jackson Snyder Presents on Hebrew Nation Radio.
Therefore let us go boldly to the throne of the great high priest. Let us go boldly to the throne room of favor. Let us go boldly to the Son of Elohim and praise, holding fast to our confession. For the word of Elohim is living and active, sharper than a two-edged sword, slicing through spirit's joint and marrow, judging intentions and thoughts of the heart.